Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Gaurav Mittal. Gaurav is a researcher in mobility and governance at Oxford University, UK. His research interests lie in the intersection of urban transformations, political economy, and transport governance. He works on investigating the policies that shape material urban mobilities in small and medium-sized cities in the Global South. In today's episode, I talk to Gaurav on his current research and his PhD work on urban transportation in Indian cities. Please do like, share, and subscribe this channel, Shortcast Over Coffee, on top podcast platforms like Apple, Spotify, etc. Now, without further ado, let's dive right in. Hello, Gaurav. Thank you and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Bala. It's very nice to be here and it's an honor.
Awesome. So you just moved to Oxford in the UK. So what are your plans? What made you move to Oxford?
I joined a position here. The title of the position is Researcher in Mobility Governance. I am here to set up a research program which would look into informal transport in Global South, especially in small and medium-sized cities, and see that what kind of transitions are happening in that transport. And when I say that, it's mostly looking at the politics of transport and also what kind of sustainable transitions are happening, how technology and politics get interplayed with each other in implementation. So that's something which I would be working on in Oxford.
Fantastic. I was speaking to Dr. Shruti Rajagopalan from the Mercatus Center in George Washington University. Sorry, George Mason University. I don't know why, but I always get confused between the two. She is a leading researcher, public policy expert, economist, and she researches a lot about India as well. With many other things that she does. And I had this question to her that, you know, why research on India while living in the US? And I would like to pose the same question to you. I mean, just to get sort of a perspective as to how you look at things from, let's say, living in the UK and looking at what is happening in the South, right? In South Asia is what I'm presuming you meant by that. Yeah.
Yes.
So, so to put across my question, so I want to know why, or does it help to be elsewhere to research on public transport and mobility in India because of how complex the situation is, right? And I think a lot of my audience would also resonate with my thought that, hey, you know, isn't it better to be in India to research about India and so on? So what are your thoughts and what advantages do you see being in Toronto and Oxford?
For me, this question could be approached from multiple ways. What I would say, like, is that being outside gives you a very different perspective on things. When you are in the middle of it, it's not that those perspectives are bad, but it's just that you, when you're out of it, you can see things very differently. Also, I mean, it has resonation with the kind of research I do. I am a comparative urban researcher. So I generally make comparisons. And I take a point which is developed by a Japanese philosopher, Karatani. What he says, parallax view. So how we can see the things by not just comparing them, like looking at two similarities, differences, and all that, but how we see things by being at different place and how our perspective changes for that. So just think of Mobius strip. as an example, from different directions, when you see the Mobius strip, it may look very different. So it's always good to get these perspectives, and that's why I say that it's always good to get those exposures and being outside also. It has its own disadvantages, definitely. Every time I need to do field work, I need to spend a lot of money, I need to a lot of carbon footprint, because flying and all that involves many things, which in current world is not great. But it also helps us understand things a bit better.
Yeah, that makes sense. However, I want to understand what might be the incentive, or what would universities outside of India see in researching on public transport or mobility in India. What do you think might be the incentives, or what are universities trying to achieve by funding such research?
So right now, the biggest push in the in the whole world is towards reducing our carbon emissions. Right, we are in the era of climate emergency. So one thing is that you cannot reduce the emissions only focusing on global north, like quote unquote global north, which we call like North America, Europe, and other developed places, because most of the population live in developing world, global south. Most of the future emissions would be coming from those areas, so we need to focus on those areas too. So if we are really thinking of anything which leads to global good, we need to take people from global south with us, and that's what universities in global north are interested about, that how to actually make this world more equitable, how to make the transition to low carbon mobility is more just. And that is why I think they are investing. I mean, I am also saying it because I'm not an insider. I'm a global south person who's living in global north. So I believe that at least that is the agenda of the universities, of hiring people like me.
Yeah, that actually makes sense now that you say it, or now that you put it this way, is because we only have one planet, and we all take in different pieces of the planet, and fortunately or unfortunately, different countries are blessed with different resources, and some of the ones who were blessed with a lot of resource just used it to their advantage. And but at this time, it's probably high time, or like how you put it, you know, it's climate emergency, right? to reduce carbon emissions. So I think the stakes are for us all, and I think it's on everyone's advantage if we could reduce carbon emissions.
I just wanted to put a caveat in that it's all not rosy thing also. It's also a lot of it also comes from geopolitics, soft power, all those things. Who is producing knowledge? Why knowledge gets produced only in global north institutions? Because in some sense, there would be some claim on that knowledge also. So it's, of course, a global good element is attached to it, but also within that, there are many geopolitical elements which we cannot oversee completely.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, it's important to look at both the sides, right? I mean, it's not all a road of roses. However, I wanted to ask you what you mean by global south, and because, you know, I'm just thinking of it as Asia, Africa. However, when you think about south, I mean, you can also think about countries like Australia, you know, probably South Africa, New Zealand, and all of that. So could you just break down what you mean by global south?
So it's a very interesting terminology, and I would say that it actually started, the whole terminology business started ever since the Second World War, when United Nations came in picture and all that, and they were like, how to see the world. So one term which you would quite familiar with would be third world. So it started with the third world when we were in the era of Cold War, when US and its bloc was the first world. USSR becomes the second world. And anything which is not first world and second world became the third world. From there, then, of course, third world had its own connotations and people did not like it. World Bank came in picture, 1980s, 90s. Economies are opening up. We are in the era of Margaret Thatcher and who was in US? I forgot.
What time are we talking about? Roosevelt?
80s.
Ronald Reagan?
Reagan Thatcher era. That's what it is called. So basically, okay. Neoliberal era, where markets were opening up and suddenly they didn't like these terminologies. World Bank comes in and they started calling it developing world. So there was a developed world and developing world. So in the last, let's say, decade or so, or perhaps decade or two decades, scholars became uncomfortable with that kind of terminology also. Also because a lot of countries were growing very fast, developing very fast, like China had a double-digit growth throughout the 90s and all that. And that's when this terminology Global South was coined. When we see geographically, it's not an accurate terminology. As you said, that there is Australia in South, South Africa in South, New Zealand in South Africa. South Africa is not that developed, but it had been this white colony for long. It's some kind of imaginary differentiation between the developed world, which is concentrated in North America, Europe, and other English-speaking countries like Australia and New Zealand, that is now considered Global North. Other countries are considered Global South. But then there are places like Singapore, Japan, which very much form the part of Global North, at least notionally. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it's like a neo-noir way of calling third world. So
that's... Yeah, it's like I joke with my friends a lot of times that every decade or two, academics need some new terminology. It helps in some way because it nuances the problems, but it doesn't solve the problem.
Yeah.
It's just kicking the can.
And it makes it extremely difficult for researchers like you to find papers from, let's say, the 80s and the 90s, because it was called something else back in those days, right?
That's true. if you see on Google pictogram, it comes right for usage of words, then you can see that how it picks up suddenly in late 90s, early 2000s. And
Yeah. Makes total sense. Gaurav, you have an interesting background. I was looking you up, and you started off with a degree in architecture, and you did a master's, and then you did a PhD in geography from NUS in Singapore. How did that transition happen? Walk me through that process.
I can take hours telling you all that, but I'll try to say it in short. After I finished architecture, I was practicing in Delhi. It was like any other architecture practice. I was designing buildings, clashing with the government offices and all that. Around that time, I got exposed to urban studies. I started attending the talks in a think tank in Delhi called Center for Policy Research. They used to hold monthly talks on urban studies, and I somehow got interested in all these questions, that how are cities formed, how are they governed, what kind of infrastructure goes in making cities. And I was looking for programs. In fact, I attended a talk in CPR, and one of the speakers in the talk was Professor Lalita Kamath, who was at that time teaching in Tata Institute of Social Sciences in Mumbai. I had a chat with her about what she's teaching and all that, got interested, kept up the conversation, so thought maybe I'll do master's in TES, in Urban Policy and Governance. So I went for that master's. Around that time, the idea was that I wanted to come back to consultancy and do some kind of consultancy work in urban studies. But the program itself made me transition to research more. And then I took some time. I worked in Hyderabad Urban Lab, World Resources Institute, got to learn research a bit more. And then I thought that perhaps I should do a PhD because I like research now. So that's how I moved to PhD. PhD was, I was planning to do it in planning discipline, but had conversations with my mentors. A lot of them made me exposed to geographic theories and all. So I, and somehow I found my home in geography, and that's what I'm continuing now. I call myself geographer, but an accidental geographer.
Yeah, very interesting transition. And it's incredible how many people I've spoken to so far in this podcast have had this one sort of eureka moment in their life. I mean, I was talking to Pranay Kotasthane, who wrote a book on semiconductors, and he was an engineer. He was just, you know, minding his own business, working in a super, you know, Fortune 500 company. And then I can't quite remember if one of his friends told him about public policy or if he just attended a talk. And then it was like, oh, I didn't know that such a thing existed, that policy making and planning and things like that can also become a career. And then he transitioned, and now he works for the Takshashila Foundation in Bangalore. So quite fascinating how, you know, a couple of things can immediately change your life, right?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of people tell, right, that in North, generally you decide in your high school what you want to do. In India specifically, you do your engineering and then you decide what you want to do. So it's somewhat same for a lot of people.
Yeah. So you go to Singapore, you do research in geography, and you publish a thesis on two Indian cities and how transportation and public policy have changed the landscape of those cities. Tell me more about that research, because it's quite fascinating, because the cities are quite far apart and have pretty much nothing in common. So tell me more.
It's very interesting because my thesis committee, when I proposed this research, told me the exactly same thing, that these cities do not have anything in common. Why do you want to compare them? And my reason was that exactly that's why, because it depends on what kind of lens you are putting into in the comparison. And my point was that how two cities which have almost nothing in common with each other could be so common when we think of transport interventions in those cities, transport in those cities. For an example, in Dehradun, if you go, you will see that public transport is provided by something called Vikrams, which are shared three-wheelers, slightly bigger size three-wheelers. You will also find Tata Magics, four-wheeler trucks. You will find city buses, which are run by private players, individuals generally. You will also find e-rickshaws. And all of these vehicles are competing with each other in providing the transport services in the city. You go to Shillong, the vehicles change. So in Shillong, you will find shared taxis, mostly Maruti 800s kind of taxis. You will find old city buses, which have been running in the city since 1940s. you will find Jain and Arambha Sage, which were bought at the time about a decade back. They were running when I was researching in the city. There were these four-wheeler trucks, which were actually financed by 13th Finance Commission or 12th Finance Commission. So different vehicles, but then again, those vehicles are competing with each other in the city. So even though the cities do not have anything common, you see that the transport scene is very much same. And that was the reason that I wanted to study that what happens, that why so many different modes of transports end up competing with each other to provide transport services to such a little population. The city, like Shillong, is a city of about 300,000 people. Dehradun in 2011 census was about 700,000 people. So they are not big cities. And still they have so many vehicles, so many people competing to provide transport services. So that was my question for my PhD.
Yeah, very interesting. So after you compared the cities, what was your conclusion? Like what did you get out of it?
Thanks for asking. For me, the biggest takeaway I would say is that how the state, and by state I mean government, but government not as a singular entity, but anything which comes from some kind of authority of government, how the government stages so much out of it. Like when it comes to transport provisions, that none of these provisions are provided by the government or controlled by the government. So it's very much out of the scene. And that's what a lot of people call informal transport. When we again go by global north terminology, all this transport is informal transport because state does not seem to have control over it. But by being outside it, how the government is able to control it even better than the government will be controlling their own services.
Can you give me some more details? I mean, that's a very interesting take.
I'll give you an anecdote and I'll try to make it a bit anonymous because I don't want to point out to particular places and particular things. Imagine that you are an auto rickshaw operator in any city, and you see that people are not able to afford a point-to-point ride where they'll have to pay you for the whole journey, say point A to point B. The cost of journey should be 100 rupees. But you know that a lot of people want to go from point A to point B. So what you start doing is that you start telling people that why don't you share the ride? And five sit in my auto and you pay me 20 rupees each. It's a fair deal. People who want to travel, they can get to travel. You get to earn the money. But by doing that, you immediately go outside the law because your permit does not allow you to do that. Now you start doing it, then more people join in because they know that point A to point B, there are so many people who want to go. So in a few years or in decade, you know that there are 50, 60 auto walaj who are operating this point A to point B service. But now you start getting threatened that if more people keep coming in, your earnings are going to drop because they are not enough passengers. So what you start doing is that you start guarding the entry. If someone else is coming in, you will say that no, you cannot operate here, go somewhere else and all that. Through that, you form some kind of cartel among the owners of auto rickshaws. And you start operating, you are providing services and everything. Everything outside the law because you are not supposed to carry passengers on sharing basis. All this while, the government official who is supposed to govern you knows that you have been doing it. But the government servant is also thinking of public court. And the government servant knows that the government cannot provide those people any service to go from point A to point B. And they anyway have to go. So they will say, auto rickshaw wala, okay, why don't you keep providing it? When they form cartel, government officer will think that it is it's good that they are forming the cartel, because it will be easier for me to regulate them. I won't have to deal with 60 different people. I will just deal with one person who will be the leader of the cartel, and I can ask him to provide the services the way I want him to provide.
But does that work though? Like, let's say I'm the owner of a cartel. I mean, not an owner, but like I'm the leader of a mm-hmm. cartel. And then I have my own sort of routes that my autowalas operate. And then the government wants to look at some public good that they want me to run some service in this route or whatever, right? Are cartels such good people that they will listen to the government and provide it for public good?
So it's the thing is that I don't like to use the word cartel, especially in Indian context, because they are very different than African context.
Right.
In Africa, you would see that there'll be a lot of murders, a lot of violence which will be attached to transport industry. In India, the transport industry is not that violent. In fact, I would say almost not at all violent. It's not, you may be a leader of cartel, but you know that you have to operate on the streets. And there are many ways for the government to impede your movement. They could put the traffic police against you and all those things. So it's a power play, basically, what happens between the government and the cartel. Government needs these auto rickshaws to operate, because if they will not operate, public will be inconvenienced. But at the same time, auto rickshaws also require some kind of government support, which cannot be a formal support, but informally, so that they can operate peacefully. So that's where the equation work between the government and the autowala. Generally, we think that it is a symbiotic kind of relationship, that you give something, you take something. That's how it would generally operate. But we forget that at the end, it is the government who has the power. In the end, it is the officer the government officers who decide that, okay, if I want, I can stop you tomorrow from operating. And these, we can call them cartel, we can call them whatever, but it's not that these people who are operating auto rickshaw, they are filthy rich. They are not even rich. They are somehow making their livelihood. So even one day of operation or 2 days of operation, if they cannot do, it affects their livelihood. So in that way, they remain controlled by the government. Although they are outside the government, they are operating separately. But the government officer would have a lot of say in how the services should be operated in the city. And that's why I say that even though government does not control it, government remains in the control of transport.
Yeah, very interesting, because government also sets rules like minimum rate and all of that, right? I have a interesting story to tell. So I'm from Kerala, and the funny thing about Kerala is there is almost no system of shared auto. Okay, so what you have is like a meter, and the driver will set the meter, and there is a minimum rate, and then per kilometer there is like a additional charge. So so for almost, you know, probably like the 18, 19 years of my life, I had never traveled in a non-shared auto. Okay. And then I moved to the north, and then I moved to Hyderabad after that. So what I see is that there is only shared auto, okay, for the most part. Yes, you can hire an auto to go from the airport to your destination or whatever. But then there is no concept of meter, right? They will just charge and then you haggle your way down and just reach some mutual consensus. But then, so I used to live in a particular place called Kukatpally in Hyderabad. And then my office was in High Tech City, which is about, I would say about 5 kilometers or probably 7 kilometers around that range. So there was a shared auto point-to-point service between Kukatpally and High Tech City. Okay. Which essentially means that it's a bus service, right? I mean, what happened was that these two neighborhoods in Hyderabad are extremely dense and there are a bunch of people moving from these two places because High Tech City is where all the employment is. Kukatpally is like a semi-residential area.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like one or two buses that would run between these two points. And what I got to know is that this so-called cartel is basically pushing the government to not add buses in the route. So what do you have to say about that? Like, because autos are pretty much replacing buses, but for, let's say, 4x, 5x the price, right? So, I mean, I'm just assuming the numbers. Like, let's say the bus rate was like 5-6 rupees. Then the auto was like 15 or 20 rupees, right? There's a bit of a problem there because I feel like buses are way more economical, way safer and all of that. And those two buses that would ply between the neighborhoods during the time were like extremely crowded. I mean, it was impossible to get in because of how less frequent they were. And even the autos were, you know, they would have like 5-6 people in them and so on. So it is difficult to reach a judgment or it's difficult to say what is right, what is wrong. But this is one of my observations about the so-called cartel, you know, pushing the government not to have bus service in certain routes.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought it up. In this, French philosopher Foucault, he had theorized these things and he calls it a relationship of war. So basically how people are fighting with each other about the things. And a lot of it is also, according to him, state-driven. So the explanation what you gave is a very common explanation which we get everywhere. But within that, we need to understand that at the first place, it was not the government which was providing any services, right? How would auto rickshaws proliferate? How would they start getting the passengers? Because you said there were only one or two buses. And probably that was the case, but as High Tech City grew, and a lot of people required residences to stay in, Kukatpally becomes the hub of residences. So people will have to travel. But there was no planning from the government side for that kind of growth and demand. So the buses remained one or two for a long time. People could not afford individual auto rides. They will start sharing shared autos and all that. The cartel develops. A lot of times we think that all that, and now that government has again taken cognizance of the situation and the situation is very bad, auto rickshaws are very expensive. So government can actually do that. They can start increasing the frequency. But we do not take the politics of it into the consideration. Because now the livelihood of 100 auto rickshaw operators who are operating in that region, that area, is also on the stake. It is not simply that the government can increase the buses and the auto rickshaws will go anywhere else, because there's nothing nowhere else for them to go. It's something akin to a lot of urban scholars who work on displacements, right? That they just slum, and a lot of times the slum is cleared and people are forced to go out somewhere else. It's not itchy because people lose livelihood in that. Similarly, the auto rickshaw operators would also lose livelihood in that. I would say that these kind of interventions generally fail. Of course, they will resist because their livelihood is at stake. But it is also because government does not take them into consideration when planning for alternative services or alternative ways to provide services. If there are enough consultations, I'm sure that something could be come out, could be worked out from these situations.
So the way I see it is, I think you bring up an interesting point where, you know, these places were sort of in the middle of nowhere back in the day, right? When the planning was done. And then eventually they grew, you know, because land was cheap. And then the autos made their way because people had to travel. But at the same time, from the government level, there was no sort of initiation to run additional buses. However, is that a good rationale to say? I mean, and the reason why I'm asking this is, let's take the case of Metro, right? So Metro is now running to high-tech city. I mean, it's been there for a while now. But can the same argument not be made to metros? And with this sort of a thought process, how can we ever develop a very efficient and centralized public transport system within a city?
Thanks. Very interesting question. Because metros have their own politics. Especially because I know I have been talking to some people who live in Hyderabad, who work on transport in Hyderabad, and they have been telling me that how a lot of bus routes along the metro lines are being discontinued in Hyderabad now, or have been discontinued, because the government wants to push people to metro. So in some sense, you can see that in Indian cities, metro is becoming again a competing mode of transport to other modes of transport. If you go to cities outside India, let's take example of Singapore, Hong Kong, London. These are the cities where the metro or whatever they will call it, underground, MRT, they will be running on high frequency, high demand routes, and the buses would mostly be complementing them. In Indian cities, we don't have that kind of complementary approach. We again keep all these modes of transport in competition with each other. Also, one thing to consider in Indian cities is that most of the metros are unaffordable for majority of the population. The fares are very high, many people cannot afford it. And if you actually discontinue buses on the same roads, a lot of people end up walking long distances. So, definitely, the cities need metro as they are growing in size, and there is a lot of demand. But we need better planning where the transport systems in Indian cities can actually complement each other instead of competing with each other. Mm. And I don't see that happening.
I see. So I think in a way you're saying that, hey, from the station, from the metro station, there needs to be like a mini transit hub, which can complement people who finally end up at the station to do their last mile transport, right?
That is one thing, but that is not the only thing. We actually have to integrate fares across the modes. We cannot expect people to keep paying at each distance. And for an example, if I have to move 5 kilometers, but I have to take an auto rickshaw to metro, then I have to take a metro ride and then again auto rickshaw, shared auto rickshaw. I don't want to pay 100 rupees for that. If I take auto rickshaw directly, perhaps I can hire an auto rickshaw directly, not even shared auto rickshaw, perhaps I can reach the same distance for 80 rupees. So by doing that, it just becomes too expensive for people to travel. And metro fares are really, really high for an average Indian person to travel into.
Yeah, that is that's an interesting point. I mean, however, that also makes me think about what happened with smartphones, right? So let's say in 2003, 2004, we would all get phones worth, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000 rupees. Probably not 2,000. I mean, like, I'm talking about like 2009, 2010, right? We would get those Nokia phones worth 3,000, 4,000 rupees. And then suddenly there is this huge shift with smartphones where people are paying like 30,000, 35,000 for a smartphone. And at the time, we would always think that, hey, who is going to pay that high for a smartphone? However, once people start to realize the advantages, you know, the multifunctionality of smartphones and all of that, then now paying 30,000 rupees for a phone is not abnormal. So I don't know, it's just a thought, but maybe similar things will happen with a metro because people will soon start to realize that it's cleaner, safer, you know, no, hassle-free.
I'm not that optimist about it, because it is not just a matter of choice. It is not just a matter of that I don't want to spend that much on certain luxury. Public transport is a public good. It's the necessity. A lot of people, just think of people who would be working in menial jobs. They might not be earning even 10-15,000 rupees a month. It would not be that suddenly they will start earning 40,000 rupees a month and they will be able to afford metro. Also, one thing which we have to understand, even in the smartphones, is that people who are now affording 30-40,000 rupees smartphone, they perhaps started with a smartphone which was 5-6,000 rupees. So smartphones were very expensive, but it was free market, of course, and a lot of innovation went into smartphones, that smartphones were first made cheaper. They became very cheaper. A lot of people got introduced to smartphones at a very entry level models, which came around 2012, 13, 14. And then gradually when they understood that they need a better capacity, they need a better RAM, they need a better display, and now they can afford it. So they are buying expensive phone. So that's what happened with the mobile phones. I cannot see a parallel with metro.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing that can be done is, I think they did that in Delhi where women were allowed to travel free in buses. So something like an income-based subsidized travel passes for metro. I mean, I completely agree with your point that it needs to be unified in the sense that, let's say, if there is a metro corporation that's doing the train services in a city, versus a BMTC in Bangalore or a Hyderabad APSRTC in Hyderabad who take care of the bus routes. I mean, if they have a common like a travel card which can be refilled, I'm surprised that's not the case in India. I think in Bangalore you can have a card for buses, however I don't think it seamlessly integrates with metro, or I could be wrong.
So the attempts are underway. I think some cards have been launched in last 3-4 years, which are called common mobility card, which can be used and all that. So again, all these things will actually help middle class for sure. The white collar population would be very happy with it. But we again forget that a lot of people are even below that threshold. A lot of people still work on cash for their daily transactions. They are not the people who would recharge a card for 100, 200 rupees and leave it and keep using it. So these steps are great, of course, and we should have these common mobility cards and all that. But we also need to make transport affordable for the larger population. Schemes like free buses for women definitely help, and there have been studies which have been done in Delhi that how it makes life of women slightly more easier, especially domestic workers.
Yeah, I'm not a huge supporter of that program that it was completely blanketing all women. It should have been income based or something. But yeah, I mean, it's still some step in the good direction. Yeah.
No, but the issue is that it's not easy to put any income based criteria in India, because a lot of India operates in informal economy. So most of the times, income based criteria generally fail. I mean, they may be successful to an extent, but they are not foolproof. I mean, I would actually say that we can even experiment something like Tallinn. Tallinn is the capital of Estonia, and public transport is free in Tallinn for everyone. Luxembourg, public transport is free for everyone. They have been, I think right now there are more than 150 cities across the world where public transport is free.
How are they doing it? What's the business model, or what is the model? Not business model, but
So the thing is that the transport nowhere, public transport nowhere covers the whole operation cost. So governments everywhere subsidize public transport. The issue is that, of course, in India, government did not put as much money, and that's why the public transport did not grow at the rate it should have grown, because government was not putting much money. But government anyway puts money in public transport. So a lot of money anyway comes from the exchequer. So what you can do is that because anyway the money is coming, you can just consider that the whole expenses will come from the government, public transport becomes free. And as public transport becomes free, a lot more people actually move to public transport. That is the understanding, although Tallinn case says that it doesn't happen. It's only about 4-5% people would move from private transport to public transport. But the idea is that the people will move to public transport more, so cities will become more healthier, generally.
What do you think happened in the capital of Estonia? Is it because, I mean, more people did not move to public transport because it wasn't wide enough, the network wasn't good enough, it wasn't on time?
No, so there is, I have had a lot of discussions with friends in India and elsewhere. The thing is that once you start using your own car, and you live in US, so you would understand it much better.
Yeah.
Once you start using your own car, it is very difficult to move you to from your car to anything else, anywhere in the world.
You know, so I have to say this. So I used to have a petrol car before, and like there was the sense of, you know, burning fuel to transport yourself, kind of a thing. And then my employer had this card where I could take the train. So I used to take my bike, go to the station, put my bike in the train, and use it for last mile transportation. It worked well in summers, but in winters it's kind of difficult. However, having said that, I think it's a me problem. I don't think biking in winters is a problem, because every city in Europe, like, you know, you name it, right? Denmark, Finland, all of them bike like copious amounts of hours every week. I mean, it's not a problem. I think it's a me problem. However, now that I moved to an electric vehicle, I'm not as, you know, like, I don't have that guilt feeling, and I drive my car a lot more, which is, again, not not the best thing to do. However, in my defense, I have to say that public transport in the US is terrible. It's not reliable at all. I think, I mean, especially if we talk about railways, right? If India is where it is now, I think US railroads are probably 50 years behind. And like, no, you will still see wooden railings on wooden sleepers on tracks. And I mean, they are electrifying the commuter rail now. And it's already 2024. So it's a very difficult situation in the US, except probably New York or Chicago. But I think you are extremely right in the sense that, you know, car does the whole point to point thing, right? And I've told a lot of my friends to try to use the public transport. And what they say is that a lot of the times when they get off work, they have so many pit stops to make. They have a dance practice, they have a yoga class and all of that. And for that, cars are more helpful or whatever. But yeah, it's difficult. I think one of the problems that US faces is big cars. I think, yes. I don't know why everyone goes for SUVs and these gas guzzling sports cars. Whereas I think in, you know, I don't know, probably 95% of all your trips on a daily basis is probably under 35 to 40 miles, right? Maybe you will take that one odd road trip. And for that one odd road trip that you're going to take in a few months, you know, once every few months, why do you need a gas guzzling SUV and an all wheel drive and all of that? It doesn't make sense. But having said that, you know, the weather, I mean, a lot of places in the US, there is snow, and, you know, navigating through snow, having winter tires and all of that is very difficult. So, yeah, I mean, I think geographically and climate wise and weather wise, there is a lot of challenges. However, you know, I want to ask you, you know, since you focus on the global south, can you give me an example of a city that has actually gotten it right? You know, and I don't want to compare Indian cities or cities of the similar demographic, economic standing. You know, I don't want to compare Hyderabad with a Singapore, because Singapore is somewhere else when it comes to public transport. But if you were to compare, like, let's say a Colombo or a Bangkok or some of the cities that have similar kind of demographics and economic status, can you name a few cities that have actually gotten it right and that have impressed you?
I mean, I think no. that would be the answer. So some cities have got something right. Not everything, but something, I'd say. Like in India, Ahmedabad has a good BRT, which operates well. Pune kind of had it, not have it, like Pune and Mahajan, but Ahmedabad BRT has been running quite well. So that is one city where you can say that some success in intervention. I mean, in the global cases, Bogota is in Colombia, it's one of the biggest example of successful BRT operation. But if you talk to my Colombian friends here, and they will tell me how many problems are there in that system, and how that system is also not like on the stretch where the system is, it is everything good. But as soon as you move beyond the stretch, things are not very great. So those kind of problems. In fact, I would say that world over, the cities who have actually got it correct, there are only three cities which will come to the top. Those will be London, Hong Kong, and Singapore. They are the three cities where you will face the least amount of problem. They will also have their own problems. London transport is super expensive.
Yeah, I have heard that. Yeah.
Yes. So it's not cheap. Singapore and Hong Kong comparatively are cheaper and better. But then again, those are city states in some sense. The government can control things much more easier in those places. So, yeah, I mean, it's all work in progress everywhere. We are trying to win one battle at a time, and
What about micro mobility ideas? Like, let's say, for instance, places like Copenhagen or Amsterdam, which are, very bike heavy and use electric bikes a lot, especially for like those 3-4 mile radius, running errands and all of that. So, do you think micro mobility can tackle a lot of these challenges?
Yes, but it also depends that what kind of micro mobility. If you see both Copenhagen and Amsterdam, most of the trips are still by bicycle, pedal bicycle. It's not electric bicycle. So some people are taking up to it. Some people are getting into hybrid, but most of the people still take trips on pedal bicycles, and I think they are great. Bicycle sharing system and all that. I'm not that keen on electric scooters for the reason that I think they have a severe impact on the health of population. There is a direct correlation between using these kind of modes and obesity because you would realize that people do not even take 10 steps if they own e-scooters and all. And walking is very important for us in general, and exercising when we are actually commuting. So, of course, they make things easier, but from health perspective, I would say that pedaling, walking, these are the modes of travel which we should be relying on, especially for 2-3 miles kind of
Right,
distance.
right. You know, to your point about people not using, not walking or not pedaling enough. So electric bikes have like different classes. So there's like a class A, class B, class C. So I think the majority of the e-bikes come under the so-called hybrid category, which is like you
Yes.
have to pedal to move, and then motor is only an assist. And it cannot go beyond, let's say, like 20 miles per hour or 22 miles per hour. So I feel like, I mean, personally, I'm a fan because you pedal a little bit, but at the same time, you don't reach your destination all, sweaty and tired and all of that. But at the same time, you burn enough calories. However, having said that, your coverage area goes up by like 2-3 miles more because of that motor assist. So, yeah,
Well,
interesting.
definitely, I am all for hybrid bikes. There, especially if you have to climb a hill or something, which you would not be doing otherwise. They have many functions. So hybrid is good. I'm very pro hybrid. But I'm what I was telling is the e-scooters, which have been taking
I
over
think
in other
I
countries.
think that's a very good point because e-scooters like the Lime scooters and Bird scooters that you see here, they are extremely unsafe. I mean, they are okay to ride on a casual promenade or like an Embarcadero by the beach, but at the same time, if it's a highly dense area with a lot of traffic, it's extremely unsafe. It has no shock absorber whatsoever, so you will feel all the bumps, and your arms are going to hurt. So, yeah,
And the wheels are so small that even the smaller bumps, you don't know, you can just get stuck in any of that bump and you can just fall off.
I mean, they are fun for like I don't know a few feet, but
Joyrides.
yeah, that's about it. Yeah, I'm not a supporter of those either because and especially in the US where there are these so-called strodes, which is like between a street and a road, which have 40 to 45 miles per hour speed range. And I see a lot of people, some with helmet, some without helmet, but I don't think it matters in this case. But they ride these electric scooters very close to the cars. And a lot of people here are not aware of bicycles on the road. Like they are still warming up to that idea that people can actually bike to work, So in a situation like that, a lot of people are not aware that there could be a bicyclist, and just that wind when a car goes at a rate of 40, 45 miles per hour close to you is very scary. So yeah, not a fan of electric scooters, but yeah, definitely I think micro mobility with hybrid bikes and the unification of like multimodal transport system can go a long, long way in making our cities more sustainable. And well, Gaurav, thank you so much for your time. I think it was very interesting talking to you to get a lot of different perspective, especially from the side of a researcher who has worked in this field for a long time. So all the very best for what you will be doing at Oxford, and looking forward to talking to you and also reading your work more.
Thanks, Bala. It was nice chatting with you about these issues. And I hope there are more conversations around transport and cities.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. All the best.
Thank you.